Imagine finding out that your entire childhood, like the scraped knees you remember from riding your bike, or the specific smell of your grandmother's kitchen, even the underlying laws of the country you live in, that all of it was just drafted up by a group of kids playing a game.
Right, yeah, it's a completely mind-bending premise.
It really is. So today we're doing a deep dive into a really fascinating stack of your sources. We've got character logs, lore notes, and combat records from the world of Mirari.
And our mission for this deep dive is to explore what is essentially the ultimate existential crisis. We're looking at how you forge your own path when your reality is, well, literally the byproduct of someone else's playtime.
Yeah, and you as the listener try to put yourself in those shoes. I mean, how would you even function?
Exactly. It is the pinnacle of ontological terror. When we look through these records, we're basically reading the internal monologues of people who have just discovered they are living inside a simulation.
A very specific kind of simulation, though.
Right, a fantasy realm manipulated by mortal children from a place called Anakin, the chief architects of this reality being a boy named Ryan Jordan and a family known as the Harcourts.
So, to sort of ground you in this world, our primary vantage point in these early logs is aboard this mid-sized black wood boat. But this boat isn't sailing on an ocean.
No, definitely not.
It is actually flying through the freezing air of a land that is locked in this brutal winter. And it's being driven by the magic of a djinn named Nishida Al-Zephyr.
Which is such a striking visual. And inside the gloomy Spartan cabin of this flying ship, we meet a character named Thomas. He's the Lord Explorer.
And he is not having a good time.
No, he is having a profound psychological breakdown. He's staring at his journal by the light of a flickering oil lamp, detailing this crisis to a fey girl named Hannah.
The trigger for Thomas's despair is it's this really specific, glaring contradiction in the world's lore. He's recently learned that his grandmother in the mortal world was actually one of the children playing the game.
Right, a mortal girl who role-played as Lady Therese of February.
Which, if you know the established mechanics of Mirari, completely breaks the underlying source code of their reality.
It shatters it.
Because Thomas belongs to House November. And in the rigid, programmed lore of this universe, the months operate as these strictly segregated biological and legal factions. A Lady of February simply cannot birth a child of House November. It's a literal contradiction in the game's architecture.
And that contradiction is the loose thread that just unravels Thomas's sanity. I mean, it exposes the absolute malleability of Mirari. Because of this logical error, Thomas realizes he might not actually have a past at all.
Right.
He starts questioning if his vivid memories of his mortal life are just like plants, just backfilled data generated by the world to construct a functional backstory around him so that he fits within the game's current parameters.
He actually writes in his log, "A man is the sum of his memories and experiences, and if mine never happened," and I want you to think about the modern equivalent of this. Imagine discovering that your entire digital footprint, your emails, your social media history, text messages dating back a decade, were algorithmically generated by a stranger just last week. Everything you thought you lived was synthesized just to make your current existence plausible.
That is deeply unsettling. And the profound danger of that realization is how it compromises your future. Because if the foundation of your identity is fabricated, the causal link between your past experiences and your current decision-making is basically severed.
Yeah, he feels totally unmoored.
Exactly. Thomas feels that if he can't trust how he came to be, he just can't trust any choice he makes moving forward.
I hear that, but I actually want to look at it from a slightly different angle.
Okay, sure.
If the system shapes itself to make your backstory perfectly believable to your own consciousness, does the historical truth of your origin actually even matter? Like, as long as the choices you're making today, right now, are driven by your own free will, isn't that enough to make you real?
Well, that's exactly the counterargument Hannah tries to present to him. She brings up a wizard's teaching, pointing out that sure, our external senses, and maybe even our memories, are unreliable.
Right.
But the immediate reality of our consciousness is undeniable. You are a witness to your own soul. But for Thomas, the systemic paranoia is just too deep. He can't separate his current consciousness from the external world, especially when that external world keeps, intruding on his isolation.
Quite literally intruding. Because while they are having this massive debate about the nature of reality, they end up eavesdropping on two other characters right outside their door.
Yeah, Sir Lefallon and Lord Averill.
Right. And they hear these fragmented, really tense whispers in the hall, mentions of a false April, rumors of a character named Simon hacking the world's rules, and most ominous of all, they hear about the Destroyer.
And they hear Lord April insisting they absolutely must keep these secrets and head to the palace to meet the Queen.
Which just sends Thomas spiraling even further.
Oh, absolutely. Those whispers compound Thomas's paralysis. He's agonizing over whether his life has meaning when the underlying rules are fake and subject to change by characters like Simon.
But see, Thomas is paralyzed by the philosophical weight of these fake rules. What's so fascinating in these combat records, though, is that out in the physical world of Mirari, we see a character who accepts those fake rules and just entirely weaponizes them.
The contrast is brilliant. We move from Thomas's agonizing debate in that dark cabin to the snowy, freezing mud west of the city. Here, we're following the knight Redmayne and her shape-shifting stallion, Ahern.
And they are tracking the greasy stench of a troll army. The sensory details in this log are just, they're brutal. The snow is all gouged up by these massive siege wagon wheels.
And we get to see the tactical dynamic between Redmayne and Ahern in action. Ahern uses his glamour, his shape-shifting magic, to disguise himself. But instead of taking the form of, like, a dragon or a terrifying beast to intimidate the trolls,
he turns himself into a scruffy, terrified, runaway workhorse.
Yes. It is a stroke of tactical genius. Because it exploits the biological programming of the enemy. Ahern understands predatory psychology.
Right. If he appeared as a threat, the troll sentries would immediately raise the alarm or assume a defensive formation.
Exactly. But by appearing as comical, weak prey, he completely bypasses their threat detection protocols. He draws two sentries right out of the shadows, isolating them.
It's the perfect bait. And the combat mechanics that follow are critical to understanding this world. Redmayne ambushes the first troll, decapitating it. And the log specifically notes that the troll's dark ichor sizzles and smokes the second it makes contact with her iron blade.
Yeah, we need to analyze why that happens, because it's not just a visual flourish for the story. In the magic system of Mirari, iron is the antithesis of the magical fabric.
Oh, interesting.
It's an unyielding, non-magical element that forcefully asserts real-world physics onto magical constructs. So when the iron blade cuts the troll, it's not just slicing tissue. It is violently disrupting the local reality of the troll's biology.
Wow, so that makes her next move even more impactful. The second troll tries to blow this massive signal horn to alert the main army. Redmayne slashes its crude scale armor, which leaves this smoldering, burned trail across its back. She cleaves a physical chunk off the horn with her sword to stop the signal, and then just impales a troll right through the chest.
With dark smoke curling from the wound.
Exactly.
Just applied pragmatism. Redmayne and Ahern then move forward to scout the enemy camp, and they discover this is not a small raiding party. It is a massive force of thousands.
Yeah, goblins actively constructing siege engines, and it's all overseen by a giant ogre foreman.
So a direct assault is statistically impossible at this point.
Right. So Redmayne relies on what I'd call meta tactics. She gathers handfuls of freezing muck and smears it all over her face and hair. She straps the troll's severed signal horn across her chest to build credibility, rides right up to this massive ogre, and she bluffs.
So good.
She claims to be an iron bearer for our lord and demands to inspect the siege engines to ensure they aren't behind schedule.
The psychology of this bluff is just fascinating. She doesn't use magic to hide. She uses the bureaucratic structure of the enemy army against itself.
Yes. She understands that an ogre foreman is basically just a middle manager in the hierarchy of an evil army, and middle managers are terrified of the executives above them.
Exactly.
So by pulling rank and acting like an auditor from corporate, she paralyzes this ogre with bureaucratic fear. She survives by playing the game's architecture against itself. She knows iron burns monsters, so she wields it. She knows ogres fear their superiors, so she performs the role of the superior.
Redmayne succeeds precisely because she isn't having Thomas's existential crisis.
Yeah.
She does not care if the ogre is a byproduct of a child's imagination. To her, the hierarchy of the enemy army is a system with defined rules, and, well, any defined system has exploits.
She plays the hand she was dealt perfectly, just to survive the next 10 minutes, but pragmatism only buys you time. To actually save this world, someone has to rewrite the source code. And that brings us back to the sunlit deck of the flying black boat, where a little blonde girl named Princess Angel, also known as Alice, and her friend Rachel are grappling with the actual mechanics of the game's rules.
It's a remarkably quiet scene, given the stakes. Angel is out in the freezing air, blowing cloud donuts with her breath, and she's discussing the origins of Mirari's physical laws.
The actual physics of the universe.
Yeah. She explains that whatever Ryan Jordan and the Harcourts pretended during their playtime just literally became the unbreakable physical reality of this universe.
And the logs give us this terrifying case study of this with something called the Rule of the Year. Angel explains that Ryan Jordan wanted to write his character out of the active campaign so he could leave and enter into history.
And just to clarify for you, the listener, history in the context of Murari's lore is essentially the game's archive state. It's the off-board retirement folder where characters go when they're no longer in active play.
Right, right. So Ryan just casually makes a rule. Kings only rule for 1 year, and then they go to history. But think of this like a programmer leaving a hard-coded loop in a software update. Because Ryan wrote that rule, it became a lethal biological clock.
Yeah, in Murari, kings now literally die when their year is up.
A child's passing whim to leave a game instituted a mandatory death sentence for the leadership of an entire planet.
Which perfectly illustrates why Angel is so terrified of trying to change the rules now. She compares making new rules to a bad genie wish.
Yeah.
You know, you ask for a lifetime supply of candy and you end up buried alive in it.
Like the classic trope, yeah.
She knows that a minor wording error in a new rule could cause complete systemic ontological collapse. She's afraid that if they attempt to fix the game, they might accidentally, like, delete the concept of gravity or make everyone in the world simply disappear.
I mean, I understand the terror of the bad genie wish, but logically, isn't her inaction mathematically worse?
How do you mean?
Well, we just saw the alternative out in the muddy woods. The current rules are actively allowing an army of trolls and a giant ogre to build siege engines that will march on her home. When the status quo is guaranteed destruction, playing it safe feels like the most dangerous choice you can make.
Is it, though? I think we have to look at the scale of consequence here. Redmayne is fighting a local, physical battle where the worst possible outcome is her own death and the fall of a city.
Okay.
But Angel is holding the nuclear launch codes for reality itself. If Redmayne fails, people die. If Angel makes a mistake rewriting the rules, existence itself ceases. Her paralysis isn't cowardice. It's a profound understanding of the burden of legacy systems.
Oh, wow. That is a really fascinating parallel. We actually see that exact paralysis in modern leadership all the time.
Exactly.
Organizations or governments are terrified to dismantle fundamentally broken economic or political systems because they fear the collateral damage of the transition. Even when the current system is actively causing harm, the fear of the unknown collapse keeps them frozen.
Yeah, it's the terror of taking responsibility for the architecture. It's so much easier to navigate a flawed system built by someone else than to build a new one and have to bear the guilt of its flaws.
Which makes Thomas's next move so significant. He has finally had enough of pacing in his dark cabin. He decides that if they are going to take responsibility for the architecture, they need to confront the original administrator.
So he and Hannah march to the stern of the boat to confront Lord Melchizedek.
And Lord Melchizedek is the Lord Protector of Murari. He takes the physical form of a massive black unicorn with a fiery mane.
Like the presence.
Right. He's this ancient, imposing figure, yet Thomas essentially demands an audit of his management. He asks Melchizedek why he would ever entrust the stability of an entire reality to the whims of mortal children.
Yeah, Melchizedek's defense really reveals the foundational vulnerability of the system. He explains the children were chosen because they were potent, like their imaginations had enough raw energy to physically shape the land.
And he claims they were friendly, right?
Yeah, importantly, he says they wanted to help build the world,
right,
with one massive exception.
Yes, a mortal boy named John Harcourt.
Melchizedek explains that John played alongside his siblings, but he carried this deep, real-world resentment. In the game, his avatar was Lord Eon. But over time, fueled by John's mortal bitterness, Lord Eon evolved. He stopped being a player and became the destroyer.
The arch nemesis of Murari.
Exactly. And this completely shifts the narrative from high fantasy into deep cross-dimensional psychology. The great evil sweeping across the land, the entity commanding the trolls and the ogres, isn't just some generic dark lord native to the magical world.
He's the literal manifestation of a human child's psychological pain.
Yes. Melchizedek even details the specific spell Lord Eon used to imprison him years ago. It's an incantation called Urjrounded.
And Urjrounded isn't just a magic word. It basically functions as a structural root-level command. It's a piece of malicious code that overrode the Lord Protector's system permissions, locking him away. Hearing this triggers a massive paradigm shift for Thomas. He realizes that if Murari is truly a reflection of the mortal world, then you can't defeat the destroyer with swords or cavalry.
Because Thomas understands that you cannot cure the symptom without addressing the disease. The war ravaging Mirari is merely a symptom. The disease is whatever psychological wound John Harcourt suffered back in the real world of Anakin.
Let me map out the mechanics of what Thomas is realizing because it's brilliant. Think of Mirari as a computer terminal.
Okay.
And the mortal world of Anakin is the main server.
So the terminal just displays what the server tells it to.
Exactly. The destroyer's army, the trolls, the siege engines, those are just localized glitches terrorizing the terminal. But the main server is fundamentally corrupted by John Harcourt's mortal trauma. Thomas realizes that no matter how many trolls Redmayne decapitates on the terminal, the underlying code is still broken.
Yeah, it's pointless in the long run.
To save the system, you have to go back and debug the main server itself.
That is precisely the cross-dimensional intervention Thomas is formulating. He tells Hannah that to fix the rules safely, without triggering Angel's bad genie wish, they have to track down Simon, confront the destroyer, and potentially find a way to sever or reforge the link to the mortal world.
He actually says, "To discover the darkness, I may have to walk into it."
He's proposing that they must map the fantasy manifestations back to their real-world psychological roots to heal the creator.
It is an epic moment of philosophical clarity. Thomas finally has a path forward that integrates his existential dread into an actionable strategy. He understands the mechanics of their multiverse.
And in a masterstroke of dramatic timing by the authors of these logs, the universe immediately interrupts his clarity with brutal physical reality.
Always the way. Just as Thomas pieces this grand puzzle together, the quiet of the flying boat is completely shattered. Ryland, a messenger crow, lands hard on the boat rail.
And the crow carries a message tethered to its leg, dispatched directly from the queen. But before Rachel can even unroll the parchment, Ryland speaks the message aloud.
He says, "The destroyer's armies have come."
And Princess Angel, the little girl who just moments ago was paralyzed by the ontological terror of changing the rules, cries out in shock. Her words alert everyone on the deck to the immediate doom.
She yells, "The palace is besieged from east and west."
It's a jarring cliffhanger. The time for existential theorizing in the cabin is officially over. The physical symptom of that mortal trauma has arrived at their doorstep, and the system is crashing.
And that cliffhanger brings the core tension of these logs right back to you, the listener. Because while Mirari is a fantasy realm operating on shape-shifting magic and flying boats, the struggle of these characters is profoundly human. Just like Thomas, Angel, and Redmayne, every single one of us is operating within systems, rules, and histories that we did not write.
We all navigate economic frameworks, political structures, and cultural norms engineered by architects who came long before us. And just like the children playing the game of Mirari, those historical architects often lack the foresight to understand the unintended and sometimes lethal consequences of the rules they hard-coded into our society.
Yeah, we are all living in the echo of their choices, dealing with the legacy of their untested code. So I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over today as you go about your routine. If our own world is just a reflection of the collective fears, dreams, and rules of the architects who came before us, what societal glitches born from their historical trauma are we still fighting today? And more importantly, when the rules of your reality no longer serve you, are you brave enough to rewrite the code?